It's a great pleasure to start today with the Melbourne captain, Max Gawn, ahead of one of the great days on the AFL calendar, Big Freeze 9 on the King's birthday. Max, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me, Jared.
You've got a weird schedule, you were just telling me, with the way you're set up, with the way the games fall around the bye.
Yeah, so 3 10-day breaks, which is the first time I'm going to be a part of something like that. So because we play King's birthday, that's the last game of round 13, and then we play the first game of round 15 on a Thursday night. So it's only 10 days between that. So our bye, technically we're coming back and there's 5 days to go after we have our 4 days off. But either side, we get looked after with 2 10-day breaks.
Has there been a bit of planning going to that?
There has. The high-performance team likes to think it's going to be a little competitive edge. We can maybe do a couple more conditioning sessions to keep ourselves fit for that back end of the year, which we struggled with last season.
Does it give you a chance to get away, or is it just not quite long enough to leave town?
The King's birthday one's unique because it's the middle of the week, yeah. Tuesday to Friday. So my wife's working, so I can't just take the family away. But after the Geelong game, I might stay around that area. I haven't done too much down the Bellarine Peninsula.
Yep.
Is it good?
Yeah. Okay. I reckon you could lose yourself for a few days there, okay. I think.
I might stick around.
At King's birthday encounter, how big is it for the club?
Yeah, it's a really exciting game. Collingwood have won, I think, the last four. Not all of them King's birthday. Some of them just a normal game. But, none of them King's birthday. It was three that were Queen's birthdays.
Yes.
Born on the same day. That's phenomenal.
Really?
The King and the Queen, isn't it?
Yes. One of the great misnomers.
Yeah. So they're top of the table. They have lost two games in almost a year. So really excited. Both of our games last year went down to the last quarter, which is typical of a Collingwood game. Does tend to go down to the last quarter. So I'm presuming it'll be that sort of game again, and I'm really looking forward to it.
We've watched this become such a cherished part of the football calendar with our blue beanies and the Big Freeze and the presence of Neil Danaher, and obviously that's got its real heart at Melbourne too.
Yeah, so I mean, 2021, Neil was all over our walls before the granny. There was quotes left, right and centre, majority of them around the selfless character that Neil is. Like, he's literally the epitome of selfless. He's fighting the disease that I'm starting to think he's going to win. Like, he's just phenomenal how much he's sticking around. But he's fighting disease he's not going to win so others can. If you take a little bit out of that on the football field, I mean, the rest is history. So I'm proud to be able to play in all nine of these Big Freeze games. Well, I was injured for one, but I've been around for all nine. Neil's come to the club every single time. It really is a great week.
The words that he has spoken to you in the past, there was one year where it was released, and it was just, it was quite striking at the time. It sort of stays with me as whenever you get an audience with Neil, it really is something quite memorable.
Yeah, you can only imagine what he would have been like as a coach.
Yes.
Just words of wisdom left, right and centre. Although you do ask like your David Neitz and your Russell Robinson and they go, this hero that is right now, he wasn't a hero back then when he was spraying us in the 90s. But he got us through to a grand final almost with the words of wisdom that we had for that final series.
Proper hot gospeler he was in the day.
Correct.
Yeah, the reverend nickname. Well, now one of the features of these Queen's birthday, now King's birthday games has always been Max Gawn versus Brody Grundy. So that's a bit different.
It is. Well, last year was Brody was obviously out injured, but normally, yes, it has been a big build-up. It's funny, I've had to turn my arch nemesis into my best friend, and it's happened pretty quickly. I thought it might have taken a little bit more of getting used to. Still a little bit on-field stuff we got to get right. We've got to work out what the best time to do all our stuff is, who's rucking at better times, and can we do some mid-quarter swaps and whatnot. But I'm really enjoying it. Obviously a big game for him. Any club that shows a player the door almost like that was, it's always a big game no matter what. Even with Brody's character, he's so laid back and you can almost think that he's not even thinking about it. But I guarantee you he probably is. So I dare say he'd probably get the first set of bounce. I don't think I can talk him out of that.
Okay.
I reckon he's got the first set of bounce. I'll see what good he says.
I was going to ask you how you think it will manifest, but that's how it might manifest. Just get into it, get into the contest straight away.
Yeah, we've shared it a lot this year, the first set of bounce. I feel like this is the one that he wants, especially if it's Mason. I think he's really good friends with Mason, so that'd be a great start.
I spoke to him coming into the season around the idea of almost swallowing your ego in the partnership he was about to take up. He's long been the number one ruckman. What about the flip side for you? Is that I saw the champion data rankings. I don't know how seriously everyone takes them, but you're not an elite ruckman anymore. And it feels like that's because of the necessity of the partnership you've taken on. How have you found the change in responsibility, in minutes, in role?
So the change is big for me as well. Even though we had Luke Jackson, I was still about 85%, almost 90 rucking. Luke Jackson rucked the back end of the third quarter in the grand final, and it's infamous. He almost won us the grand final. So I was still doing about 90%. So it's a big change for me as well. I remember Goody sort of pitching it to me, talking about, because Luke Jackson started getting more and more time, and then we started talking about bringing Brody in. And I just questioned my own worth, and he explained it pretty simply. He goes, I can get you a 7-4 Australian, and I'm making that sound incredibly easy. I dare say Tim English would have it anyway, even if I was rucking, but I can get you a 7-4 Australian, or I can get you a second premiership captain. Like, odds are, I mean, there's a chance that I could have done both, but you'd pick the second one every day of the week. And he said the best way for us moving forward is to have two really big ruckmen who can mark the ball down the line, who can go forward and kick goals, and who can really dominate that centre square. All three of them, we're still waiting to perfect. Sometimes we nail it one week with one of them. We've never really had all three in one game. I do know that taller and bigger men tend to get bigger in finals. So I am excited to get to that part of the year, but I'm all in on this idea. I'm 31. I almost did my knee at the start of the year. Like, things can happen just like that. And Goody's pretty hell-bent that two rucks is going to be the way to go. And to be fair, a lot of the teams that are going well have got two big men. Collingwood have Cameron and Cox. Essendon have had a resurgence with Draper and Phillips. Geelong have Blitzarves and Reece Stanley or Segler. So there's always that two sort of big men. So I feel like it will work.
How does it change the equation for your self-worth and how you measure yourself in a game?
It's been challenging. There is noise outside. I don't look into it too much. I've had noise around bad form before. But I've played, how many games is there? 8-4, so 12. I've missed four of them. And out of the 8 games, I've had coaches' votes in probably 5 of them. So that's a little bit of worth for me, like knowing that I'm still not getting the numbers that English and Marshall and these guys are throwing out now as a ruck, and they're two of the best rucks going around. But I'm doing what the team needs me to do at that time, and that's all I really care about. I need to be strong down the line when the ball goes for a bailout. When I'm rucking, I need to help out my defenders. And one thing that I'm not doing, I'm thinking 4 goals, 9 from set shots. I've got to start to kick them. I'm doing a lot of work with Choco. Choco's doing a lot of work with me. The one face I don't want to see when I kick 1 goal, 2 is Choco when I walk in on a rondo. He wears them pretty, he really lives and breathes the goal kicking program. So I'm excited to clean that part of my game up. But yeah, the only thing I need to do is tick off winning and then to play my role within.
So how significant a moment, so late in the Carlton game, you are being challenged and your moment arrives from outside 50, and that is the goal that you know how to kick.
Yeah. I don't know how, I tried it in a JLT game about 3 years ago because I haven't had that license to kick from outside 50. Yep. And I think we were up at a practice game. I said, I'm going to have a crack at this, and I kicked it. And then therefore I've had my license. So now I don't have to centre it, which is a great thing to have. I feel a little bit more confident the further out I am. I feel like I can kick through the ball. I talk goal kicking 4 times a week. So for those, and there is people at home that think I'm joking around it and not caring too much. Like, I do that much goal kicking, it's not funny. So I am getting there. When I got that, I was sitting on the bench just before that. And if you remember the game, we had about 7 or 8 inside 50s in a row, and Carlton rebounded from all 7 or 8. It was a bit of a frenetic start of the last quarter. And I was on the bench sort of commentating to myself and the other guys on the bench saying, we need to take a mark and we need to calm down. The next person who takes it, take your 30 seconds, kick the goal. And it was me.
Yeah.
It happened to be 70 metres out, but it was me. And I said, I'm going to try and con the umpire into a 30 seconds here. And then when I realised how far actually out was, I'm like, all right, I'll probably have a shot as well.
Yeah. You alluded to this just at the start. So how close are you and Brody working together off field, just developing a friendship, that sort of thing?
It's been natural. You don't want to force anything like that. He's early on, I was, as with every ruckman we've gotten over the time, Braden Pruce, Luke Jackson, I try and teach and help. And then you realise he doesn't really need that from me. Like, he's beaten me on the field, so he should teach me. And now we've worked out that balance. It's really nice. The one thing we've got to work out more is when someone's really going well on the ruck, just go sit forward for a little bit, do your thing, which I think worked well on the Brody did a majority of the second and the third quarter because he was really working over TDK. And then I had a whole last quarter where I was feeling really fresh and I played probably my best quarter for a while. So that's where I see it working, where Luke was almost like, oh, I need a minute to get back. Let's get Luke in there for a minute and then let's get him back out, where Brody can dominate for 6 or 7 minutes and I've just got to park my ego and sit forward, which you say park your ego. I've got an ego as a forward as well. One thing that I really wanted the coaches to know, if I'm going to be a 50% forward, and to be fair, at the early parts of this year, almost a 60, 70% forward, I need to be talked like a forward, not a ruckman who's sitting forward with his arm in the air and kick it long and there's seven people in the pack, which means I need to buy in, for one, to be a forward. So I need to work with the forward patterns, forward pressure, and two, I want them to teach me like a forward. And that's sort of working. Getting a lot of marks inside 50, getting a lot of looks, just got to kick the goals.
So the splits that you two work together, are you in control of those? What's the coaching influence and what's for the two of you to sort out in real time on the field?
Basically, the magnet at the start of each quarter is picked by Goody. I think it's there's no method behind it. I reckon he just forgets to change it, or there's just a name up on the ruck and the other one's either on the bench or forward. And then we can do what we want within. Obviously, there's a rotation as well, so we both go off at some point. So there's a little bit of method from them and there's a little bit of method from us.
Melbourne captain Max Gawn in the studio. Just the course of the season. So last year, we know, started 10-0 and then went the way it went. This year, a lot of scope, it looks like, for evolution, for problem solving. How would you describe the course of this season so far?
The last two seasons were perfect starts. We're 9-0 in the 2021 and we're 10-0 last year. That's fairly abnormal. I know in 2021 there was another team that was doing it with us. I think Western Bulldogs were 9-0 as well. It's fairly abnormal to have that. As a captain, we played some unbelievable football the back end of 2021, maybe the best for a long time. You do chase that because that's where you know you can get to. That's not really chaseable. Like, it's good. It's good football and we can get somewhere near that. But that was really good football for 7 weeks. We don't need to play that to be able to win games of football. Probably don't need to play that to win a grand final. It was exceptional football. So we're going to be happy with 8-4. And in fact, I'm ecstatic with 8-4. Would have loved to win those games. But there's 14 other clubs. Well, I think we're third. There's 15 other clubs that would love to be where we are. So we're in a great position. We would have loved to beat Essendon at Adelaide Oval, but we didn't. We would have loved to Bailey Fritch to kick the goal at Adelaide Oval. And we beat Port. Fremantle, we had a chance to win the game as well. So we would have loved those results to change. But they're all learning opportunities. We played a pretty poor game against Port on that Friday night. And if Bailey Fridge kicked that goal, do we review it as much as we would have if we lost? So they say it's a loss you have to have. Technically, that one was. And maybe that'll hold us in good stead going forward. But obviously, I don't want to keep on losing. Yep. I'd love to go 11-0 for the rest of the year. Probably won't happen. But yeah, you just take learnings along the way. And that could have been, I'm delving into this answer, but in 2022, so we're 10-0 after winning the flag. We think nothing's going wrong. We're doing it again. We've won every game off the back of being the best team. So we don't change our team when we lose a couple because we go, we'll just get back to that same team. We don't evolve our game plan. It seems it's starting to work us out in that back end of 2022 because in fair right, we've won 15, 16 games in a row with this setup.
Yep.
So to have a little bit of adversity throughout the year, I think will help.
So are you evolving at the moment, would you say?
Yes, certainly. The way Fremantle beat us is a way that we've been beaten before. They took a lot of uncontested marks. They switched a lot on us. They tried to man up Maisie and Jake Lever, which sides tend to do. So to learn from that again is a really good thing. When it happened last year, it was our first loss of the year. Maybe we just had a mishap today. Today it's like, okay, this is our fourth loss of the year. And this is something that teams are starting to do to us. So how do we bring out something? So we're bringing Adam Tomlinson to play on Harry Mackay. Stephen May and Jake Lever probably have their best games of the year combined. So we're learning, evolving. Can be frustrating when you lose to teams because all four of the losses apart from Brisbane, so three of the four are teams that we were probably favourites to win the game. So that can be frustrating, but 16, 17 teams are pretty even. Actually, you can add North to the list now. We got them later on in the year. They're all games you can drop.
So the record against other contenders, so the high-end tests, and you're about to walk into one of those next Monday. Are they of added significance now? It's probably been a stumbling block since round 11 last year through to now.
Like I said before, I think all teams on their day provide a pretty big challenge. We played Port, who apparently weren't a contender when we played them, who'd won five in a row and now are seen as premiership favourites. We played Fremantle off the back of winning three in a row and finding form. So it's about when you play teams as well. But we feel like I said, we're a kick away from Port playing a pretty bad game of football. This is a good test. Collingwood is a good test. They are the benchmark. They're in every game. You could have a 50-point lead and almost still think you might need to kick another one to get it done. So do we look at the Collingwood game more than what we'll look into the game on the weekend against Carlton? Definitely not, because Carlton's best stacks up. They beat Geelong. They drew with Richmond at the start of the year to start the season. I'm not sure if we ride that narrative like a lot of the external people do. Yep.
And your status within the competition. So we noted at the start of the year there's been such a big turnover of captains, and now you're a premiership captain, probably the most experienced or right on the cusp. Then we've seen sort of Darcy Moore's evolution. Did it feel like the mantle had passed from those long-term captains who'd been there forever and a day and the search for the next alpha captain?
It almost feels like captains change more now, don't they? Teams are more happy to just change things up. And also captains nowadays don't have that massive ego about captaining literally till the day they retire. Like Nathan Jones was an incredible captain for us. Jack Viney was as well. It was time to move on in 2020, and Jack Viney has grown as a player. Nathan Jones at that time grew as a leader when he left the captaincy role. I'm really enjoying it. Is my time up at any point? Like, I'm happy to move on. Like, I'm happy to, if let's say Jake Lever's our next premiership captain, let's get him in there because I want to win a flag. I'm 31, almost did a knee in round two. But it is exciting seeing so many new faces. Like Darcy Moore's Anzac Day speech was one of the best things I've heard. And had we heard from Darcy Moore much before that? Probably not. So it's like good to get that person speaking. But Captain's Day was phenomenal start of the year. It was Gil and Darcy for an hour. It used to be Gil and Joel, but Joel not there. Darcy just said, "I'll take lead." And it was a phenomenal debate. They were going over my head what they were even talking about. But so I already know Captain's Day next year, I can sit back and just watch Darcy do his thing.
Max, you know a thing about a good venue or two. You've got our local is yours, East End.
Thank you.
At the Sporting Globe, so the Queen's birthday or King's birthday, I've got to get that in my head. The King's birthday sold out. If you haven't got a ticket, the Sporting Globe would be a good spot to go and take all of this in.
You do have to get that in your head though. King's birthday, I think it's a king for the near future. Yes, I'd say almost the next century. So we'll get there.
We will.
No, Sporting Globe, I actually don't mind a pot at the Sporting Globe. It's a good, there's the one in Richmond tends to be the one I flow to. Morty Alec every now and then. That's a five-level extravaganza, the Morty Alec one. But no, good place to watch a footy.
Max, it's great to see you. Thanks for stopping by the studio. Good luck for Monday and beyond.
Thanks for having me.
Melbourne captain Max Gawn with me in the studio. You could make the case that what's happening between the PGA Tour and LIV is the sports story of the century so far. A transfixing 36 hours as we watched events unfold with measured reactions, and we've grappled to understand how it's come to pass and what it all means. We're in great hands this morning. Revered golf writer, author, journalist Bob Harrig is with me on the program. Bob, welcome back to SEN.
Hey, thanks for having me. How you doing?
Have you known a story like this in your working life?
Not quite, I don't think. This has a lot of different tentacles to it. I mean, obviously it's a huge story, but it's also a shocking story. If we'd have known it was coming, it would have been huge. The fact that we had no idea. There was nothing to suggest that there was going to be any kind of collaboration between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf or the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. And so, here we are about a day and a half later, still trying to digest it all.
When you first heard, Bob, just take me to the moment of revelation and how you reacted to it.
Yeah, look, it was in the morning here. I'm in Florida. It was just before 10 a.m. I actually got a text from someone saying, something about a LIV PGA Tour merger that I just thought it was ridiculous. I didn't think there was any way that could be happening. And then I got a call from a colleague of mine who asked me, did you see this CNBC thing? CNBC being a cable business channel here. And he told me that Monahan, Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour commissioner, and Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who's the governor of the PIF, the Public Investment Fund, were together being interviewed jointly. And then soon right after that came a release from the PGA Tour announcing this collaboration, whether it be a collaboration or partnership or merger, however you want to classify it. And, I sort of had to catch my breath because I almost couldn't believe my eyes. And then I realized, my God, I got to get this out there. And so like I scrambled to write, six or eight paragraphs trying to explain it. And then the day just went on with adding to it, explaining it, trying to get reaction. And I quickly found out that nobody knew.
Yes.
Nobody. None of the players on either side were aware. They heard about it like when we did. A few of the top players might have been given a heads up. Other than that, it was nobody. And, we're still trying to sift through what it all means.
Could you describe the level of acrimony that there has been to, as you call the notion, ridiculous? And I think we all would feel the same way. It felt like a move that they would only pull in professional wrestling.
Yeah, well, the reason that there's acrimony on the PGA Tour side is that for a year, the tour, look, let me say this, the tour has obviously, and it's no shame in them pushing back against a potential rival. I mean, that's just going to happen. They were not going to let somebody just come in and say, oh yeah, sure, take all of our players. They were going to not be good with that. They have television contracts and sponsorship deals based on, agreements that they are going to deliver the top talent in the game, on a consistent basis. And that's put in peril when somebody else comes along. So all that's fine and good. And, the tour was enforcing its rules, trying to, if you didn't get a release to play in events, you were in violation of your membership. You could be fined or suspended. All of that played out. But I think where the tour, has found itself in a bind now is they also went down the road of criticizing LIV for its financial backing, the Sovereign Wealth Fund, the PIF, and its association, obviously, as the Saudi with Saudi Arabia. And, in the U.S., there's a lot of bad feelings about Saudi, even though they are our ally. But, there's certainly evidence to suggest that they were involved in the 9/11 attacks. They've got a very poor human rights record. This has been well vetted. And the idea of working with them or taking their money, in many circles has been viewed negatively. As I'm sure you've seen, a lot of the LIV players have had to deal with that backlash, understandably so. So now after using that as an excuse to not do it, have the tour then turns around and becomes partners with the very entity that they criticized for all this time and did their best to keep people from joining them. It wasn't going to go over very well. Jay Monahan's being called a hypocrite and he took it on. He admitted that, I look like a hypocrite, but things changed. And, they changed to the point where now they're going to be partners with this group that has, virtually unlimited funds.
The players' meeting was clearly volatile. I am curious just to tap, what has the public reaction been to that? I mean, it feels like just rank hypocrisy, Bob.
Yeah, well, it is. I think that's the reaction. I think it depends on which side you're on. If you sided with the PGA Tour, you're very disappointed that they would go down this road. There was a sense that the tour was winning in its lawsuits, that LIV was not prospering, that LIV was struggling with TV ratings, that people weren't, latching on to their format. Now, I would argue too, though, that it depends on where you are. I mean, down by you guys in Adelaide, I realize it's not right next door, but it's in Australia, and that event went off with you know, a lot of positive feedback. You know, obviously it was very well attended. It seemed to do well in Australia. There's a lot of attention, a lot of media coverage. That's the sort of thing that they've been looking for that they've not really gotten here. And so the people on the PGA Tour side were just flabbergasted that after all of this time, you would now, you know, get into partnership with these same people. The LIV side of it has viewed it as a victory. They see it as validation. They think that their format is going to be a part of this now going forward in this separate entity that the tour is going to form, this for-profit entity that will be separate from the PGA Tour. I think that is still to be determined. There is a lot of differing opinions on how this will look going forward. Will there be a LIV like we know it now? Will it even be called that? How many tournaments will they have? Will they still have this team structure? What about all these captains and all these promises that were made? I mean, there are a million things that are going to come down the pike here in the next several months. And frankly, we just don't know how it's going to shake out.
Have you formed a view, Bob, as to who holds the balance of power?
It's a great question. I mean, if you talk to the LIV people, they think that they hold it because Yasser is the chairman, going to be the chairman of this new entity that has not been named. And given that all the funds they're putting in, you know, that maybe they're going to call the shots. The PGA Tour side of things cites that Jay Monahan is the CEO of this new venture, that he will have more board seats than the PIF, and that they will call the shots. I don't know who to believe. You know, frankly, this hasn't all been signed, and all the details have not been worked out. And, you know, as it's playing out in public here, you know, in the short term, you know, they've got some things that they need to straighten out and let the public know about. Who's in charge? You know, who is in charge? And if the PIF is in charge, well, then, you know, then they've just taken over, you know, they might only be in charge of that one aspect of it, but still that's important, you know, because their funding is going to help the other side, the nonprofit side of the PGA Tour, which runs all the events, all the big events, you know, like the Canadian Open that's going on right now. So, it's messy. And, you know, they're all smiles and handshakes and patting each other on the back now. But I mean, behind the scenes, I think there's some crucial decisions that need to be made, and it's going to really impact how this is shaped going down the road.
Bob Harrig is with me. His pieces are up on Sports Illustrated on the website. So the two from today, we had to hear from Rory McIlroy. What did you need to hear? What did you hear, and what did you interpret from Rory's press conference at the Canadian Open?
You know, I think he handled it as well as you could expect. He admitted that, you know, he was taken by surprise. He explained why he thinks it will be good in the future down the road. He said it stings a bit personally because he put himself out there. He went down the road of saying LIV will not look like LIV today. Now, again, the LIV side of things pushes back on that, but he seemed adamant. Like, you know, LIV will not exist as LIV. You know, we might have a bit of a team aspect, but I don't see it much beyond that. LIV contends differently. And we will see what happens there. But, you know, and he talked about how, you know, if the players who left the PGA Tour and want to come back, they're going to have to pay some penalty. That needs to be decided.
Is there any hint as to what that looks like?
No, that hasn't been determined, and that will be interesting. You can't just let them come back freely because they broke the rules. No matter what you think about LIV and all this stuff and whether you believe what the tour was doing was legal or not, the bottom line is those were the rules. That's what they signed on to. 15 events minimum. You got to get releases and you'll usually be given three. And then after that, you know, you need to, on a case-by-case basis, make your pitch. Well, they were denied the releases for live events and they went and played anyway. So they, you know, they broke the rules. Now, what's the penalty for that? Will there be a financial fine? I mean, they've all been suspended or they've all resigned their memberships. So to get back in good graces, what are they going to have to do? Is it going to be a hefty fine? Will they, you know, let's say they wanted to come back next year. If they do, if any of them do they have to sit out for 6 months? Do they have to not compete in the live events or whatever they're called? That would seem to be counterproductive to the merger. You know, I mean, if you're going to start a new thing, you want these guys to be able to play. But by the same token, you can't just probably let them waltz back onto the PGA Tour. So, you know, my guess is there's going to be some hardliners that are going to want to hammer them, going to want to make them pay a huge amount. You know, but we'll see. I mean, I just don't know for sure how that will play.
The other key figure to hear from was Greg Norman, and you've written the piece of he hasn't been heard from publicly, but he held a private meeting with staff, and you had details of that.
Yeah, I mean, over 100 people on that call. That shows you how big of an organization LIV is. And let's be honest, you know, those people are the ones that, you know, sadly could be really hurt by all this. You know, I mean, we're talking about all this money, right? And golfers just getting richer. But what about the people who went to work for this? You know, they're just doing a job. You know, same with people at the PGA Tour. They're just everyday people doing a job. And will this impact their jobs? You know, I mean, that would be tough. But Norman, who has been quiet, who's been in the sort of been in the background lately, has been not making decisions on behalf of LIV. You know, he's been more of a figurehead. He was put in charge of having this meeting with the entire company, and he spoke nothing but positively about it. He basically told them business as usual.
Yes. Which is a hard notion to grasp with on the outside.
It is. I mean, you know, based on what we've just learned, I don't know how you can be planning into the future when you don't know exactly how this is going to, you know, shake out in terms of what's going to be done. I mean, if the tour has its way, it'll be, I'm sure, like, you know, it'll be, you know, 6 or 8 events at the most. It'll be rebranded. It'll be under the tour's, you know, nameplate. And, you know, they will work to get, you know, a TV revenue from it, and they will maximize it to their benefit. You know, that makes it hard to believe that there could be franchises and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, and team owners and the vision that LIV had for it. But who knows? I mean, I don't put anything, you know, I don't discount anything at this point because given what's going on, I just don't think you can.
Bob, there's a political side to this as well. So I was reading, I don't know how significant the Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy is, but he tweeted, so weird, PGA officials were in my office just months ago talking about how the Saudis' human rights record should disqualify them from having a stake in a major American sport. I guess maybe their concerns weren't really about human rights. So there's obviously a level of suspicion, but is there a level of unease as to how the Saudis have essentially successfully infiltrated a major American sport?
Absolutely. I mean, the same thing they were arguing against, they are now, you know, embracing. And, you know, Chris Murphy is one of 100 senators. He's, you know, in the United States, that's a pretty prestigious role. There's only 100 of them. They have a lot of sway in our politics. And, you know, it's obviously concerning when the very entity that was pretty much lobbying in government places against these guys, they didn't want them to be able to come into the U.S. or have any part in golf. And now they're partnering with them. Yeah, it's going to rub some people the wrong way. I mean, you know, from a pure golf standpoint, you take the politics out of it. Sure, the money's great. Awesome. Terrific. You know, it's going to only help the sport. But like, what is the end game? What are, you know, there's been protests already by the 9/11 families. They feel betrayed. You know, they felt that they had the PGA Tour on their side. Now they're mad at the PGA Tour. You know, there's a group of people that that to this day obviously grieves what happened in 2001, and anything to do with helping out Saudi Arabia. You know, 15, I believe 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. There's evidence that suggests that the government then, you know, I think you had to, you know, make that clear. It's not the same government now, but that the government then, you know, might have been involved in planning it. And you know, obviously that's going to bother people. And so, it's raw. It doesn't go away. So, and then, you know, we just know how they are. They execute people. They're terrible with you know, gay and LGBTQ rights and things like that. That, you know, in other places around the world, we try to be tolerant, right? And so, you know, here I am, a golf writer, and having to learn about all this stuff. It's complicated, and I, you know, I try to understand both sides, but you can see where the angst comes from on that.
So, Bob, as we close, as someone who loves golf and who has dedicated their professional life to golf, how does it leave you feeling as to what's going to happen to your sport now?
Yeah, I have just a bit of an uneasy feeling about it, to be honest. While I didn't have any problem with LIV from a golf standpoint, you know, I was of the opinion that there's nothing wrong with watching, you know, more golf, right? PGA Tour, LPGA Tour, Champions Tour, European Tour. When they play the Australian events in your summer, it's great viewing for us at night here. You know, their motto was additive, but it's obviously so much more complicated than that. And, you know, the PIF has now wiggled its way into the professional game. How much power are they going to exert? Like, if you're paying the bills, are you going to get to call the shots? You know, they've already made inroads in other sports, like the Premier League football. You know, the same guy, Yasser, who's involved with LIV, is the governor of Newcastle United, you know, one of the 20 Premier League soccer teams. And they've been pretty successful under Saudi leadership. And, you know, they're trying to normalize. They're trying to make the West see that, you know, hey, look, we're in soccer. We have golf tournaments in our country, tennis tournaments, F1, you know, and I think they'd like to become more of a tourist destination. So they want to build more golf courses. And to what point and to what kind of ambitions do they have? Does it impact, you know, our own sports? I think that's the uneasy thing that we all wonder about.
Bob, hugely indebted for your time today to take us through it, not only the mechanics and the politics, but the emotions as well. And your work over the past 36 hours has been exceptional. Thank you very much.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Golf writer Bob Harrig.